So up next, Frank Chapman, and he's going to talk a little bit about CPAC and the mission of the Chicago Alliance.
Good evening, everyone. I've been saying this a lot lately. Power to the people.
All power to the people.
That's a slogan that come out of the 60s that grabbed me the first time I heard it. And since I've seen so much power taken away from the people since then, it grabs me even more now. That's what the fight for CPAC is about. It's about empowering the people who have been left powerless in the face of police crimes and criminality. Because only the people who have been abused by the police, who've been murdered by the police, who've been repressed by the police, are qualified and capable of controlling the police. Now that's a democratic right that we don't have a debate about, because it's an inalienable democratic right. We have the democratic right to say who polices our communities and how our communities are policed, don't we?
Yes.
And when did we give that up? We never gave it up. They took it from us. And so we got to take it back, right?
Right.
And so that's what CPAC is about, taking back what is rightfully ours, asserting our inalienable democratic rights. So much is going on. I'm not going to try to talk about it because we have a keynote speaker here tonight, and I'm not going to upstart him. But the thing of it is that so much is going on that we couldn't possibly digest it and present it properly in the few minutes that I have to speak. So let me just hit the highlights in terms of what the challenges of the Alliance and our movement is and where we intend to take this. When Trump got elected, I went to a meeting right afterwards. I was called to it. And everybody went around the room and introduced themselves. And every single person in that room talked about how afraid they were, how frightful him being elected was. Nobody said they were ticked off. Nobody said they were mad. Nobody said they were ready to fight. They talked about fear. And we are not about fear. We are about fighting back. When we come under attack, we have to stand up and fight back. Fear immobilizes people. That's what it does. But fear has two aspects to it. Flight and fight. So when you can fight, that's what you do with fear. When you can't, well, you know the answer to that. You run away to come back for another day. So what we are focusing on in terms of our movement is the fight back. What do we do? What do we do? What do we do to put an end to white supremacy? What do we do to stop the terror that is being visited upon our community by politicians who have made a career out of exploiting and abusing us? What do we do? And the Alliance has some very specific things that we are asking you to do. I'll go over them one by one. It's not but three major things. One is we want you to join us in the communities, on the corners, when we're out on the corners petitioning and mobilizing people to sign the postcards to their aldermen, demanding CPAC. We want you to join us when we demonstrate for CPAC. We want you to join us in the fight for CPAC. I want you to do that. We also want you to join us in another very important fight. There are over 118 torture victims in this state. This is the only state in the United States that has a commission on torture. I'm looking at Amanda Shackelford, Amanda Stanhope. Her son has been in prison for 27 years for a crime that he did not commit because he was tortured. He was given a medical condition through his torture, which is still being treated, so he's still being tortured. His case is one of the cases that we'll be highlighting, but we're talking about over 118 cases. And these people, we have a duty and responsibility to get them out of jail.
Yes, sir.
There is no excuse for a country that calls itself a democracy to have people who were tortured and imprisoned 27 years ago, and most of these people were teenagers at the time. They were legally children. So there's no excuse why they are still locked up. There's no excuse. This is unacceptable, and we're asking you to join this fight. Are you with us?
Yes.
I didn't hear you. Are you with us?
Yes.
All right. Okay, the third thing. How many of you saw the video of Laquan McDonald? Okay, that's almost everybody here. So you know that was an execution. It was an execution inspired by a man who was so full of hatred, until after he had emptied the clip, he was trying to put another clip in the gun when his fellow police officers stopped him. Now, we don't get all of that on tape because they doctored that tape. But we saw enough on tape, didn't we? We saw enough on tape to know that this was first-degree murder. So he has been indicted for first-degree murder, and he is going to be on trial for first-degree murder, but they're trying to figure out a way to let him go. We cannot allow that to happen. We cannot allow that to happen. What just happened in St. Louis with Stockley, he's got the same name, the same first name as Jason Van Dyke. His name is Jason Stockley. What happened with him can happen here. It can happen here. It's the same system. It's the same corrupt, racist to the core system. So it can happen here. It is our duty and our responsibility to stop it. So the next time we call up on you to come down to that courthouse, we expect to see you there. Are we going to see you there?
Yes.
Again, I didn't hear you. Are we going to see you there?
Yes.
Okay, act like you mean it. You got to come down. We got to protest. We cannot let Jason Van Dyke walk. We can't do that. Okay? So those are the three main things I wanted to talk to you about and let you know that we're doing and get your engagement in. There are many other things going on. I don't have time to speak on all of them. The attack on immigrants in this country has got a very sharp, racist cutting edge to it. It is our duty and responsibility to unite with that struggle and be in solidarity with it. We just saw our sister Rasmiel Day deported from the country. That was a racist frame up if there ever was one. I've never seen one like it since the Angela Davis case. It was a criminal trial. It was a political trial disguised as a criminal trial. And we have got to up our guards. We've got to get up our guards because that means that they're going to be coming after us. It doesn't end there. That just opens up the gate. There should have been tens of thousands of people out at that airport rallying. We got to up the ante. We got to get people out. We got to get off our rusties and dusties and fight. If we don't fight back, we're not going to win. We may not get everything we fight for, but we got to fight for everything we get. And on that note, I'm going to surrender the mic.
All right. Just real quick, raise your hand if you've ever tabled with CPAC on Saturday on the north or south sides. Awesome. Raise your hand if you've ever attended a Chicago Alliance protest, ever. Raise your hand if you're ready to fight for the three things that Frank just laid out. All right, good to see you out there on Saturday. So up next, we have another musical selection from CoStar. Give it up, everybody, for CoStar.
They got those red and blue lights. They blast in heat up on us big time. They kill us by the numbers that be genocide. They kill us by the numbers that be genocide. They wrap that red in blue and white. They beat us blue, spill out our red till we see the white eyes. They beat us blue, spill out our bread till we see the white light. They beat us blue, spill out our bread till we see the white light.
Don't you know that I am a human too? Don't you know that I am no different from you? Don't you know that I got a family at home? How am I the criminal when you're the one holding the gun?
Frank Chapman and Ted Pearson to the stage.
I've known Reverend Queen Mother Helen Sinclair for some years now. I know her first as a person who has given her life to the people who are in prison in Illinois, who spent all of her life with her mother, and then after that herself chaplaining, ministering to the people, men and women in prison in Illinois, especially in some of the worst prisons in Illinois. In the course of her work, her daughter participated with her, following in her footsteps, and met one of the people that we are very involved in the defense of today, and that's Johnny Veal. And Helen Sinclair's daughter, Famita, is married to Johnny Veal and is a part of the network of people who are supporting his campaign to get out immediately on parole and ultimately to be exonerated, because we are absolutely convinced he was framed and innocent. Helen Sinclair has been involved in this campaign for his freedom for many years, and in the campaign in general for the conditions and the lives of the men and women in prison. So it's really an honor for the Alliance, I think, to be able to present this honor to Queen Mother Helen Sinclair today. Would you like to come up and receive the, please?
I came out here and didn't say anything. They would kill me dead. As you learned, my name is Helen Elizabeth Sinclair, the daughter of Jesse Mar Houston, the schoolmate of Clarissa, the president of the Jesse Mar Houston Prison and Jail Ministry of the Rainbow Push Coalition that we started back in 1945 when I was just a young girl. There was a war that had just ended, and my mom went to Cook County Jail. There was only one building, now there are 11. When they put the 11th building up there, I cried because I knew they put it there for my people. And so I don't want to go away from here without telling you something about the background of the Jesse Mar Houston Prison Ministry. We started the prison. My mama went to the jail because a young man who was a boarder of hers, she tried to show people how to eat with Dick Gregory and Dr. Fulton. This man ate with her, and one day they put him in jail. My mom said, what are they doing putting him in jail? So she said, I'm going out to the jail. And my church looked and said, Mom Houston, I lost a man. She's going out there with them people. They didn't know you're supposed to go to the jail. Just because it says in Matthew, you know, I was in prison, you're visiting, people didn't see that. But Mom saw it, and she went out there, and I followed her because I was the only child born in Hot Springs, Arkansas, way back in 1920. And so I came from Hot Springs, Arkansas, where my brother had been killed in a prison farm. which is why my mom and dad left Hot Springs, Arkansas. I'm in the prison ministry because I was brought up in it. I came from Hot Springs, Arkansas when I was 4 years old. And so I went to Cook County Jail. My mama met the warden. They gave her own key. And she would go in there and swing the gates and go in there and see the brothers. They had meetings in the electric chair, where the electric chair was right in there. And then my mama started working with five young men. These young men were supposed to be electrocuted. They call them the McNeil and Libby murder hold-up. And my mama went to seeing them, and she went to giving the preacher, preaching to them. And so they went to praying for me. She said, pray for my daughter. I said, mama, pray and pray. And here I am doing a prison ministry, because they had them brothers praying for me. I had no idea I'd be doing a prison ministry when I got older. But I started doing it because I started following my mom. And I told my daughter, I said, what are you doing going to Cook County Jail when you were 16? She said, I wasn't 16. I was 12. I said, what did you do when she got you? She said, I said, it is no secret what God can do, what he's done for others, he'll do for you. With arms wide open, he'll pardon you. That's what she was doing, 16. And so my mom kept doing this prison ministry, and along came Dr. Martin Luther King. And Dr. King got with Ma Houston. He said, I believe in going to the jails and prison. Dr. King said, when Ma Houston prays, I feel okay. She marched with him on every march he was ever on in the city of Chicago. And I remember when they were out over in Gage Park, they were throwing bricks at them. The Gang Nation saved them from getting killed. The young men who are in prison right now, many of them was out there covered my mama and Dr. King. My mama prayed every day when they got ready to go march. She had to do the prayer before they left Lincoln Park. Reverend Jackson said, Ma Houston was 65 when she started marching with us. And she kept on marching to the end. Her birthday is October the 4th. Reverend Jackson's his age. They had their birthdays together. And I said, if I don't tell these people something about Ma Houston and Reverend Jackson and Dr. King, I will have neglected. This young lady I went to school with, she's one of the smartest people in the school. We still be together. We were back 1937, 1938, New Salvo High School. Dr. Mark Burroughs. Oh, no, that's my other friend, Dr. Burroughs. She went with me for 25 years to Cook County, Pontiac, Stateville, Joliet, every prison. We went to them. Half of my team is out here now. I said, if I don't go, them people are going to kill me. And then we put an ad in here, and Reverend Jackson's going to kill me, too. I didn't say nothing. I don't want to get killed. So I just want to tell you, I want to tell you a little bit that we are somebody. All right? Thank you. Now,
it's my honor to present this award. I first met Carlos Ramirez Rosa last year. I met him after he became elected. And we went to his office to talk to him about endorsing CPAC and helping us get the legislation passed in the city council. He made a few recommendations as to what he thought should be changed in the legislation, particularly regarding the rights of gay people and trans people. And so we said, well, why don't you make those changes? And not only make those changes, but why don't you join our team? And he said he was going to think about it. Next time I heard from Carlos Rosa, he was introducing our bill into the city council. And he called us to the press conference, and what I liked about that press conference was he said, and all of the media in Chicagoland was that, he said that he did not collaborate with any of the other members of the city council, that isn't what inspired him or moved him to introduce the legislation. He said what inspired him to introduce that legislation was he saw the 5,000 people that our alliance and the Black Lives Matter movement had put into the streets. He saw them in motion, demanding CPAC. And so he felt it was his duty to introduce it. Also, he felt it was his duty to introduce it because members of his ward had also been talking about CPAC. So with great honor and all due respect, I want to present this award the Charlene Mitchell Human Rights Award to Alderman Carlos Ramirez Rosa in recognition of your leadership in the struggle to secure justice.
Well, I'm a politician, so I'll share a few words, as politicians do. But I truly want to say thank you so much to Ted and Frank. Thank you to CoStar for sharing that beautiful work of art with us. And thank you to all of you for being involved in this movement for community control of the police. Now, I truly do not feel that I am deserving of this recognition. And that is because I have done what I feel we are all called to do. And that is to use that precious little time that we are given on this earth to fight for justice, to fight that all of us are recognized for the precious and beautiful human beings that we are. Whether they be a child born in Palestine or a child born in Englewood, we are all human beings deserving of dignity and respect. We live in very scary times. We have a billionaire governor and a billionaire president hell-bent on turning back the clock on women's rights, on queer folks' rights, on workers' rights. We have a president who says that everyone that does not look like him, right? So if you are not a rich white man, apparently you're a threat to the United States of America, if you listen to the words that Donald Trump says every single day. But in these dark times, I am reminded that change has never come from up above. It's always come from people coming together and pushing that change from below. I'm an elected official. And that means that people in my community trusted me to represent them in the Chicago City Council. And it is my belief that an elected official's job is to stand with movements, not to stand in their way. And so the question before every single progressive elected official today is that when you see the tens of thousands of people that have signed on to CPAC, when you see the thousands of people that have taken to the streets to demand community control of the police, are you going to stand with them or are you going to stand in the way?
All right, that's right.
So I am not a saint, I'm a sinner. And Lord knows that I have done many bad things in my life. But I hope that it is said that when I'm judged, that I never turn my back on movements for justice, that I never stood in the way of movements to recognize the humanity of all people, that I always stood with them. The moments that I felt most powerful in my life is when I've been in the streets. And in this moment when we see the attacks that our community is facing, I want to remember and remind us of one of the first mega marches that I've ever participated in my life. The year was 2006. And much like today, we had a Republican president and a right-wing Congress, and they were moving a bill, the most anti-immigrant bill to ever pass the Congress of the United States, H.R. 4437, the Sensenbrenner Bill. And in response to that bill, right here in the city of Chicago, the city of the Haymarket Martyrs, 500,000 people took to the streets from all different backgrounds, black folks, Latino folks, Asian folks, white folks. And they came out into the streets and they flooded Jackson Boulevard. And they marched from Union Park down to Federal Plaza. And they kicked off a movement that not only stopped that bill, but spurred a movement for immigrant rights. Y'all remember that march? Was anyone here there at that march? Yeah. So in these times, I want us to remember, all of us that are anxious or scared about our future, that we have the power. And if we all come together like we did in 2006, if we all come together in that collective force, we will bring that change from below. Is that right, sisters and brothers?
Yes.
So thank you so much again to the Chicago Lions for this award. Thank you so much for leading this movement for community control of the police. We're going to win. Thank you.
Okay, up next we have our final musical selection from CoStar. So give it up, everybody, one more time for CoStar.
All I want to do is take the chains off. All I want to do is take the chains off. Yeah. All I want to do is be free. All I want to do is be free. All I want to do is take the chains off. All I wanna do is take the chains off. Yeah. All I wanna do is be free. All I wanna do is be free. 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 I just wanna be free.
Gerald Horn. He will be giving the keynote address. Gerald Horn is a man of many accomplishments. Currently, he is the John J. Rebecca Morris Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. Over the years, his research has addressed issues of racism in a variety of relations involving labor, politics, civil rights, international relations, and war. A prolific author, he has written more than 30 books and 100 articles detailing those issues and the work of many of the individuals and groups who have contributed towards the achievement of equality and justice. So give it up for Dr. Gerald Horn.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me. I didn't realize I was going to be speaking in a holy space, because I'm going to be speaking about a very vile subject, which is the 45th president of the United States of America, and I feel like I'm desecrating this holy space by bringing up such an ugly subject. In fact, I've already decided to ditch some of the naughty jokes I was going to tell about this man, given the space that we're in. Sorry? But first of all, let me thank those who invited me, particularly Clarice Durham and the Birthday Boys, Ted Pearson and Frank Chaffman. And let me also congratulate the awardees, Reverend Helen Sinclair and Alderman Carlos Ramirez Rosa, who I'm sure you'll be hearing much more about in coming years, given his presentation this evening. And let me also say it's always a pleasure to come back to Chicago because, as the introductory remarks suggested, I do a lot of writing and research about radicalism and labor history, and you cannot talk about radicalism and labor history and African-American history without talking about Chicago. And on the other hand, to those whom much is given, much is expected, and that is to say that if this nation and ultimately the planet is to pull itself out of this deep crisis in which we now find ourselves, Chicago is going to have to play a major role. So in preparing my remarks for this evening, I felt a certain liberation, since I know that I didn't have to oversimplify to a Chicago audience. I did not have to engage in any kind of misdirection for a Chicago audience. And I'm also choosing to be frank and candid because with all this talk about a rising fascism in this nation, it seems to me it's better to be frank and candid and to have this discussion now rather than at the internment camps in Wrigley Field on the north side or Guaranteed Rate Field on the south side. I think we should be candid now rather than there. And this brings me to the theme for this evening, which was anticipated by William Shakespeare over 400 years ago when in Timon of Athens he asked plaintively, what means that trump? Now, of course, Shakespeare may not have had in mind the definition of trumpery, that is to say, showy but worthless. Assuredly, the election of the 45th U.S. president has presented a profound crisis for this nation and indeed the world. On the global scale, he's threatened North Korea with fire and fury. I'll interject my naughty joke now, and you can stone me if it's too naughty. Actually, it's from Conan O'Brien, who, after Mr. Trump said that he was going to rain down fire and fury on North Korea, Conan O'Brien said he spoke to Melania Trump. And she said, you know, don't pay attention. He promises that every night and nothing happens. Most recently, he's pledged to destroy North Korea. And of course, according to Jimmy Fallon of The Tonight Show, that must mean he plans to become president of North Korea because he's destroying the United States as president of the United States. He's threatened a trade war with China. He's caused Moscow to accuse Washington of, quote, state-sponsored hooliganism, unquote, after the U.S. authorities in early September entered Russia diplomatic compounds in this nation for unauthorized searches. He's threatened military intervention in Venezuela, sought to roll back his predecessor's entente with Cuba, threatened to junk a finally wrought nuclear deal with Iran, which could not only entice Iran to develop nuclear weapons, now forestalled, but could also cause this country to be more isolated than it already is internationally. This erratic regime has threatened to upend relations with nations as diverse as Mexico, Germany, and South Korea. And withdrawing from the Paris Climate Accord, he's displayed a cavalier attitude towards climate change. And of course, as a person who barely escaped from Houston, I'm very sensitive about that issue, given Hurricane Harvey. At home, Trump began his campaign in June 2015 in Manhattan, demonizing those of Mexican origin. He's questioned the impartiality of a judge simply because he was of Mexican origin. He's compounded that attack by seeking to trick the Dreamers, those predominantly of Mexican origin in this nation through no fault of their own, now threatened with deportation. He's confessed to being a sexual predator on the now notorious Access Hollywood tape. He sought to purge transgender troops from the military just as he issues one bellicose threat after another, targeting various nations. He's offered a tax cut plan that enhances the welfare of the 1% while leaving unaddressed the real needs of many of the 63 million who voted for him. He sought to overturn overtime rules promulgated by his predecessor, and if successful, this would mean a wage cut for millions of workers. He's given aid and comfort to neo-Nazis and Klansmen in the aftermath of that notorious August 2017 outrage in Charlottesville, Virginia, with his attempt to draw moral equivalence between those supporting and protesting neo-fascism. And he's placed in the doghouse those who objected to his offensive words, including economic advisor Gary Cohn and Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. Trump's Justice Department, under the misleadership of one Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III, has sought to wound affirmative action in impugning the bona fides of African-American and Mexican-American youth in particular in leading colleges and universities. He sought to lift the ban on turning over warfighting tools to local police departments, which could only mean more carnage in our streets and the deaths of more Michael Browns and Laquan McDonalds. He sought to overturn the Affordable Care Act, thus jeopardizing the lives and well-beings of countless millions, and again, including many who voted for him. He's relied relentlessly in such a manner that mendacity is now being normalized with disastrous implications of what remains of the moral fiber of this nation. So obviously, all of us have to ask, how did we come to the brink of this disaster? And just as important, what can be done to drag us away from the precipice? And that'll be the substance of my remaining remarks in the next few minutes. Now, unfortunately, many of the analyses that seek to respond to these inquiries are incomplete, if not misleading. What I mean is that some have provided what they deem to be a working class analysis that focuses on how certain workers defined as white voted in 2016 in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania in particular. Interestingly, if you were to do a Google search, you probably would find the use of the term working class, interestingly enough, skyrocketed during 2016, since previously the vague term middle class has been the preferred term in this country for wage earners, not least by some of these now born-again class warriors who are putting forward what they consider to be a working class analysis. This suggests that reviving the term working class in certain circles so suddenly was an indicator of how this kind of analysis has not been sharp and incisive to the extent that it would have weaknesses in explicating this 2016 electoral debacle. Similarly, there has been insufficient focus on what Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton discusses in her recent memoir, What Happened? That is to say, how and why 52% of women defined as white voted for a confessed sexual predator. Of course, segmenting the working class in a racial manner is flawed from the inception, not to mention that it does little to explain why workers not defined as white, such as workers of African descent, tended to vote against Trumpery by a margin of 9-1. Such racial segmenting feeds this misguided narrative that we should pay more attention to the suffering and misery of Euro-American workers, since presumably other workers are doing just fine and dandy, thank you very much. Likewise, much has been made about the alleged Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. Setting aside the cogent point that given Washington's frequent interference in foreign elections globally, it was inevitable the chickens would come home to roost, setting that aside for a moment, it is worthy of consideration to note that the supposed hundreds of thousands of dollars Moscow purportedly spent on Facebook ads and on other means somehow did not influence black women who voted against Trumpery by a rate of 95-5. I presume that they look at the internet and surf Facebook, etc. Those who maintained that the hand of Moscow tipped the presidential scales in 2016 are duty bound to provide an explanation of this race come gender differential. However, don't hold your breath for such an explanation, I'm afraid. Moreover, even though some of our friends have disdained a class analysis until recently for fear that it might open them to unfounded charges of being closet Marxists, some have sought vainly to explain this 2000 presidential election on class grounds while ignoring the unavoidable factor of race in that, as ever, the GOP lost the majority of votes amongst people of color broadly defined. Still, we would be remiss if we chose to believe that the election of this fiasco in the Oval Office was a bolt from the blue, an anomaly, an aberration. Indeed, it seems that after every national disaster in this country, the shooting of children in Newtown, Connecticut, or even a presidential election, we are told, quote, that's not who we are. This mantra is repeated so consistently and relentlessly that one would think that USA actually stood for the United States of Anomalies, or the United States of Aberrations, or as the late writer Gore Vidal once put it, the United States of Amnesia. This pattern actually defies pattern recognition, which is the basis for doing an analysis, which suggests that such an approach basically forbids analysis, as if every disaster is virtually inexplicable and thus defies not only anticipation but prescription and remedy. It's almost like the music of Duke Ellington, where the United States itself is rendered beyond category, or like the work of certain poets and painters, which are considered to defy interpretation. Such a thoughtless analysis would replicate yet another fundamental flaw in the current discourse on what ails the United States, that is to say, contrasting the alleged superiority of a mythical past and contrast with today's troubled future. What I mean is, what is taught in our schools is that there was the supposed Grand Revolution in 1776, constituting a great leap forward for humanity, which of course flies in the face of the fact that the indigenous people were expropriated and subjected to genocide, which worsened tremendously after the founding of the Slaveholders' Republic, not to mention Africans, not just on these shores, where the African slave trade increased spectacularly after 1776, but also in Cuba, where U.S. slave traders had ousted the Spanish from control of the slave trade as early as the 1790s, or Brazil, where U.S. slave traders are largely responsible for the fact that this nation now contains the largest population of African descent this side of Nigeria. This was the immediate fruit of this so-called Grand Revolution. This approach, which salutes the alleged superiority of a mythical past, only serves to replicate the myopia of the current fraudulent slogan, Make America Great Again. Go back to genocide and mass enslavement. In other words, some of the alleged stalwart opponents of Trumpery are actually putting wind in his sails. This is no minor matter, since remarkably more and more within the mainstream, not to mention the left, are mulling the possibility that the United States may be on the brink of a unique kind of neo-fascism. And let me point you to the events of the last few hours in particular, where Mr. Trump has picked a fight with millionaire black athletes, Stephen Curry and Colin Kaepernick in particular, in order to inflame his base on a race class axis. Recall that when the founding father of modern Bulgaria, Georgi Dimitrov, began writing in the 1930s about fascism, or the naked terroristic dictatorship of the most backward elements of the ruling class, it seemed that this phenomenon was correlated directly to the rising challenge from the left, particularly unions and left-wing political parties, with fascism seen as a rebuke to this challenge. Now, how is it that the United States is said to be on the brink of fascism, though with respect, the United States does not seem to have the potent left-wing political parties and allied unions that were present in Italy in the 1920s or in Germany in the 1930s, not to mention Chile in the 1970s? Why is it that a disturbing list of right-wing commentators, including former Nixon aide Pat Buchanan and current Trump advisor Roger Stone and wildly popular right-wing talk show host Michael Savage, all have warned of, quote, civil war, unquote, if the 45th U.S. president is removed from office even by legal means? Let me remind you that the last civil war on this soil involved the slaughter of over 700,000, a bloodbath of spectacular proportion. Now, fortunately, some of even our liberal historians or providing us with insight that may help to resolve this matter of why the United States is said to be on the brink of fascism, despite not having the kind of radical left-wing movements that many had thought was a conditioned precedent to the rise of fascism. The first point to acknowledge is that it should come as a surprise only to those who have not been paying attention that a nation that endured mass enslavement, genocide of the indigenous, and Jim Crow could be capable of unleashing fascism. In any case, many of these historians don't go as far as I go in the book that's out on the table, The Counter-Revolution of 1776. However, they are marching right up to the brink. I'll point you to the prize-winning book by Robert Parkinson, The Common Cause, or the recent book by the most decorated U.S. historian now writing, Alan Taylor, in his book American Revolutions, both of which move decisively away from the creation myth about the founding of the slaveholders' republic. I would add to this growing list the recent book by Michael Klarman of Harvard Law School, The Framers' Coup, which revises downward the heroic understanding of the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights in particular. I would be hesitant to get medical treatment from a physician who has not kept pace with the literature, or with a lawyer not current on recent court opinions and legislation. But unfortunately, I'm afraid that many of our political leaders have not kept up with the evolving understanding of the political landscape they're seeking to influence, suggesting that their political estimates, their strategies, and tactics may be askew, which is one more reason why we may unfortunately stumble into neo-fascism. However, even if one has not kept pace with the reinterpretation and reimagining of the tawdry history of this nation, there is sufficient evidence in recent events to make one think long and hard about the prospect of a surge in fascism. After all, as we mull over this distinct possibility, we should not forget that in 1991, a card-carrying Klansman and Nazi, David Duke, received 55% of the Euro-American vote in a failed attempt to become governor of Louisiana. Perhaps because it is deemed to be an inconvenient truth, few analysts seem to acknowledge or even care that in the heart of Dixie, since 1964, GOP standard bearers routinely receive 80 to 90% of the Euro-American vote and a staggering example of cross-class collaboration. We should not be surprised that a reality TV star gets elected president when a declining action movie hero got elected governor of California, or a washed-up professional wrestler got elected governor of Minnesota, or that a backward music performer, Kid Rock, is being seriously touted to become a U.S. senator from Michigan. And fortunately, instead of engaging in pattern recognition and attempting to divine what this disturbing pattern tells us, too many treat each episode as wholly unique, which may be comforting, but ultimately delays the moment of reckoning, which now may have arrived with the election of the 45th U.S. president. History, however, may provide a clue as to this dilemma in which we are now facing, particularly this conundrum of how we could be talking about a rising fascism when the historical pattern has been rising fascism usually arises to confront a rising left-wing movement, which, with all due respect, and I consider myself part of the left wing, I can't say that I'm on the verge of becoming governor of Texas. Now, if you look at the history of this country, for example, you may have noticed that there was a black scare in the 18th century. That is to say, the terrifying possibility that had congealed in the minds of many settlers that the Africans, in league with the indigenous, and perhaps with an assist from a foreign power, first Spain before 1776 and Britain thereafter, would rise up, which in fact did occur in August 1814 when Africans in red coats sacked Washington, D.C., sending the slave-owning president James Madison fleeing into the streets one step ahead of the posse along with his garrulous spouse Dolly. This was occurring as the Haitian Revolution, 1791 to 1804, had ignited a general crisis of the entire slave system in the Americas, which could only be resolved with its collapse, which it proceeded to do circa 1863 to 1865. In sum, in an episode which you are more familiar than most, though Chicago and Barack Obama ruled as largely a centrist, it may not be coincidental that the man who embodied the so-called birther campaign, putting forward the absurd claim that the 44th president was illegitimate, not least since he was supposedly born in Kenya, representing the latest version of the Black Scare, it's not surprising that the leader of the birther campaign emerges as his successor. In any case, it is not useful to speak of emerging U.S. neo-fascism without placing this phenomenon in a historical context that pays attention to the historical peculiarities of this republic. Now, of course, we do recall that many of our friends and comrades thought that during the height of McCarthyism, fascism was imminent, particularly when a seeming man on a white horse, General Eisenhower, was elected president in 1952. Instead, a mass movement assisted by strong global currents caused the retreat of Jim Crow and the illiberalism that propelled it. So that should make us cautious about making large claims about the rise of neo-fascism. Similarly, as we seek to gauge the imminence of fascism, we should take note of the defeat of the neo-fascist National Front in France, the decline of the ultra-right-wing UK Independence Party, which pushed Brexit through in June 2016 in Britain. Tomorrow's results in Germany should be studied very carefully, particularly the totals rung up by the so-called Alternative for Germany Party, which is blatantly and boldly neo-fascist. That'll give us some idea about what might happen on this side of the Atlantic. On the other hand, there was the defeat of the ultra-right in elections in Holland and Austria. Despite setbacks, the alliance in South Africa remains in the saddle, as do their comrades in the former frontline states. Of course, on the other hand, there has been a retrenchment of the progressive forces in Latin America, particularly in Brazil, where I'm afraid there is a surging neo-fascist movement that in many ways is stronger than the neo-fascist movement in this country. In other words, to assess the prospects for neo-fascism in the United States, we must pay close and careful attention to like-minded movements globally, not least in this hemisphere. Now, let me be clear. In order to struggle together against Trumpery today, we do not have to agree on the fruits of 1776 yesterday, just as we do not have to have agreement about the future of this country as long as we agree on the present, which is a relentless struggle against Trumpery and Trumpism. Still, my own opinion is that one cannot make an adequate political estimate of the forces on the battlefield, which political generals and privates alike must do, unless one has an adequate understanding of settler colonialism and its roots in white supremacy. Let me also say, I'm going to skip ahead a few points, that if you really want to understand how we got to this crisis, you do have to understand Moscow, but not in the way that's now being touted in the press. That is to say, in the previous epoch, the Cold War, the United States not only found it necessary to spend trillions on the Pentagon rather than on education and healthcare, but more than that, it was felt that left-led unions, like the National Maritime Union and the International Longshore and Warehousemen's Union based on the West Coast, had to be weakened. And when these left-leaning unions were weakened, this made a sector of the working class not only poorer, but ideologically vulnerable to the blandishments of a con man like Donald J. Trump. Likewise, part of the Cold War bargain was to cut a deal with the People's Republic of China on an anti-Moscow basis, which then led to runaway shops to Asia, but did not contemplate the creation of this juggernaut in Beijing, which with every passing day is constraining opportunities for the United States of America. So this brings me to my final point, that is to say, what we need to do. First of all, Chicago, which is replete with migrants from Dixie, should take a special responsibility in the field of Southern solidarity. Perhaps unions and related groups should exact a special tax to sponsor organizing in the South, as was done with Operation Dixie after World War II. As the 2016 election suggests, the massive anti-Trump vote in this state can be negated by the fact that Dixie continues to remain an outpost of reaction, yet it has an Achilles heel in the form of a sizable black population which tends to lean against the right. Let me say parenthetically that in terms of trying to explain fiascos and debacles, I'm all ears as to how Chicagoans can explain how you elected Bruce Rauner and how he has been able so far to get away with vetoing a minimum wage bill that would have raised the hourly rate to $15 an hour by 2022. How did he get away with that? Second, speaking of unions, Canada, in the midst of the NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement renegotiation demanded by the White House, is now demanding that states in the United States junk their so-called right-to-work laws or right-to-work-for-less laws or anti-union laws, which would be a step forward for progress in this nation. That is to say, obviously, we should be joining with our Canadian friends and gaining momentum from their effort in terms of getting rid of these anti-union laws. Third, we should not shirk the impeachment remedy as we gear up for the 2018 elections. In the current issue of the New York Review of Books, Noah Feldman of Harvard Law School co-authors a case for the prosecution based on Mr. Trump's violation of the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution, most recently when a large delegation from Malaysia, the Southeast Asian nation, stayed at the Trump Hotel in Washington and paid premium prices, with that money going directly into his pocket. Another charge, of course, would be obstruction of justice and the firing of FBI Director James Comey, defamation of Barack Obama and charging him falsely with wiretapping. The list is long. We should not be intimidated by the fact that his backers threaten civil war if we are successful. Finally, this demand of Canada And my previous analysis suggests that the global prospects for fascism, helping to determine the domestic prospects, should remind us of the importance of global currents in propelling us forward in this nation. This was true during the bad old days of slavery, when the Haitian Revolution and the strength of British abolitionists played a central role in abolishing slavery, or how the rise of decolonization in Africa and the Caribbean had impact on Jim Crow in this country. We should build upon victories. For example, our pressure caused the sacking of Sebastian Gorka, the White House aide with murky ties to Hungarian fascists, and Steve Bannon, the so-called strategist with not-so-murky ties to what is euphemistically called the alt-right. Pressure should now be placed on key Trump aide Stephen Miller, the anti-immigrant tribune, and his aide Julie Hahn. Interestingly, like Bannon, both have roots in Southern California, which with its Latino plurality is seen as particularly hostile to white supremacy, the GOP, and immigrant bashing. And of course, absolutely finally, speaking of Los Angeles, it would do well to study the example of the Chicago Alliance and its push for a civilian police accountability council, which when implemented will serve as a major deterrent against the lawless slayings of our youth, which of course is a precondition to the rise of fascism, when our youth can be mowed down in the streets without due process of law like their dogs. Thus, despite the apparent odds, I'm confident that we can amass the domestic and, yes, global forces to bring Trumpery to its knees. And as this process unfolds, I am confident even more that the Chicago Alliance and Chicago generally will be in the forefront. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Horn.